The World Health Organization declares the coronavirus outbreak a pandemic.
We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
Bernie Sanders stays in the race at least for one more debate, and a judge rules in favor of Chinatown in a fight against four mega towers. Harvey Weinstein is sentenced. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Wednesday, March 11th, 2020. Disgraced movie mogul Harvey Weinstein has been sentenced to 23 years in prison for sexually assaulting two women. His defense team had asked for 5 years. Judge James Burke handed down the sentence to the 68-year-old former Miramax producer on Wednesday. While scores of women have accused Weinstein of sex crimes, he was convicted last month specifically of third-degree rape and first-degree sexual assault charges against former production assistant Mimi Haley and aspiring actress Jessica Mann. Both were in court to watch the sentencing. Weinstein did not visibly react to the sentence, according to witnesses, though he personally pleaded for mercy before it was handed down, claiming he felt remorse for the situation. Mentioning Mann, Weinstein told the court, somewhat strangely, "I really, really was under the impression that I had that kind of relationship 5 years with Jessica." During her victim impact statement, Haley broke down crying as she described being assaulted by Weinstein. And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, a key indicator of stock prices, tumbled almost 1,500 points, losing 6% of its value. The market is now 20% below the record high set a month ago before the coronavirus shook the world's economy. All major indices were also down almost 5% for the day. Losses intensified on Wednesday after the World Health Organization declared the outbreak an official global pandemic. A pandemic is a term used to describe a disease that has spread throughout the world, involving many countries. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, the number of coronavirus cases around the world has totaled more than 100,000. In the United States alone, more than 1,000 cases have been confirmed. Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, a component of the National Institutes of Health, appeared before Congress today in response to a question from Representative Carolyn Maloney. He says coronavirus in the U.S. can no longer be contained.
First yet to come, Dr. Fauci.
Yes, it is.
Can you elaborate?
Well, whenever you have an outbreak that you can start seeing community spread, which means by definition that you don't know what the index case is, and the way you can approach it is by contact tracing. When you have enough of that, then it becomes a situation where you're not going to be able to effectively and efficiently contain it. Whenever you look at the history of outbreaks, what you see now in an uncontained way, and although we are containing it in some respects, we keep getting people coming in from the country that are travel related. We've seen that in many of the states that are now involved. And then when you get community spread, it makes the challenge much greater. So I can say we will see more cases and things will get worse than they are right now. How much worse we'll get will depend on our ability to do two things: to contain the influx of people who are infected coming from the outside, and the ability to contain and mitigate within our own country. Bottom line, it's going to get worse.
Well, bottom line, Mr. Fauci, if we don't test people, then we don't know how many people are infected. Is that correct?
That is correct. And as I'm sure that Dr. Redfield will tell you, as the looking forward right now, as commercial entities get involved in making a large amount of tests getting variable, when you do two aspects of testing, one, a person comes in to a physician and asks for a test because they have symptoms or a circumstance which suggests they may be infected. The other way to do testing is to do surveillance, where you go out into the community and not wait for someone to come in and ask for a test, but you actively proactively get a test. We are pushing for that, and as Dr. Redfield will tell you, that the CDC has already started that in 6 sentinel cities and will expand that in many more cities. But you're absolutely correct. We need to know how many people, to the best of ability, are infected, as we say, under the radar screen.
And that's Dr. Anthony Fauci. President Donald Trump will address the nation tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on his plans to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and Wall Street's precipitous decline. Trump has suggested Tuesday a 0% payroll tax that could last until the end of the year. Airlines and cruise ship companies saw broad declines as tourist destinations like Italy go on lockdown, but steep drops were seen in bank shares as well. Meanwhile, WHO's Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, addressed the public Wednesday. He said in 2 weeks, the number of coronavirus, also known as COVID-19 cases outside China, have increased 13 times. With more than 118,000 cases in 114 countries, the death toll is at nearly 4,300. He says thousands more are fighting for their lives in hospitals, but he adds the numbers of people sickened by the virus will only increase, and the time has come for action.
Days and weeks ahead, we expect to see the number of cases, the number of deaths, and the number of affected countries climb even higher. WHO has been assessing this outbreak around the clock, and we're deeply concerned both by the alarming levels of spread and severity and by the alarming levels of inaction. We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic. Pandemic is not a word to use lightly or carelessly. It's a word that, if misused, can cause unreasonable fear or unjustified acceptance that the fight is over, leading to unnecessary suffering and death.
And that's WHO's Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. The word pandemic has nothing to do with how serious an illness is. It only means that it's spreading widely. Ghebreyesus says the new epicenter of the pandemic is in Europe, calling the continent the new China. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte said Italy will shut down most businesses across the country amid the fast-spreading coronavirus outbreak, leaving only pharmacies, food markets, and certain essential factories open. Iran is by far the hardest-hit country in the Middle East. The senior vice president and two other cabinet ministers were reported to have been diagnosed with the virus. The death toll stands at 354. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Former Vice President Joe Biden won the most delegates in Tuesday night's voting, widening his lead over Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. But unlike losers after last week's Super Tuesday primary, Sanders is continuing his fight for the Democratic nomination, at least until next Sunday's one-on-one debate between the Vermont senator and Biden.
Night obviously was not a good night for our campaign from a delegate point of view. We lost in the largest state up for grabs yesterday, the state of Michigan. We lost in Mississippi, Missouri, and Idaho. On the other hand, we won in North Dakota, and we lead the vote count in the state of Washington, the second largest state contested yesterday, with 67% of the votes having been counted. We are a few thousand votes on top. What became even more apparent yesterday is that while we are currently losing the delegate count, approximately 800 delegates for Joe Biden and 660 for us, we are strongly winning in two enormously important areas which will determine the future of our country. Poll after poll, including exit polls, show that a strong majority of the American people support our progressive agenda. The American people are deeply concerned about the grotesque level of income and wealth inequality in this country, and the American people want the wealthy and large profitable corporations to start paying their fair share of taxes. Overwhelming support for that. The American people understand that the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour is a starvation wage, They want to raise the minimum wage in this country to a living wage of at least $15 an hour. And the American people understand that if our kids are going to make it into the middle class of this country, we must make public colleges and universities and trade schools tuition free. The American people understand that we cannot continue a cruel and dysfunctional health care system. And it is amazing to me to see that even in conservative states like Mississippi, there is an overwhelming understanding that we are now spending twice as much per capita on health care as do the people of any other country, while 87 million of us remain uninsured or underinsured. And this crisis, this absurd health care system, is becoming more and more obvious to the American people as we face the challenge of the coronavirus pandemic that we are currently experiencing. Imagine facing a pandemic and having 87 million people who are having a difficult time going to a doctor when they need. And the American people know, unlike Donald Trump, that climate change is an existential threat to our country and the planet, and that we need to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. And the American people also know that we need fundamental transformation of a broken and racist criminal justice system, as well as a cruel immigration system that keeps millions of people living in fear. But it is not just the ideological debate that our progressive movement is winning. We are winning the generational debate. While Joe Biden continues to do very well with older Americans, especially those people over 65, our campaign continues to win the vast majority of the votes of younger people. And I am talking about people not just in their 20s, but in their 30s and their 40s. The younger generations of this country continue in very strong numbers to support our campaign. Today, I say to the Democratic establishment, in order to win in the future, you need to win the voters who represent the future of our country, and you must speak to the issues of concern to them. You cannot simply be satisfied by winning the votes of people who are older. While our campaign has won the ideological debate, we are losing the debate over electability. I cannot tell you how many people our campaign has spoken to who have said, and I quote, "I like what your campaign stands for. I agree with what your campaign stands for. But I'm going to vote for Joe Biden because I think Joe is the best candidate to defeat Donald Trump." End of quote. We have heard that statement all over this country. Needless to say, I strongly disagree with that assertion. But that is what millions of Democrats and independents today believe. On Sunday, I very much look forward to the debate in Arizona with my friend Joe Biden. And let me be very frank as to the questions that I will be asking Joe. Joe, what are you going to do for the 500,000 people who go bankrupt in our country because of medically related debt? And what are you going to do for the working people of this country and small business people who are paying on average 20% of their incomes for health care? Joe, what are you going to do to end the absurdity of the United States of America being the only major country on earth where health care is not a human right? Are you really going to veto a Medicare for All bill if it is passed in Congress? Donald Trump must be defeated, and I will do everything in my power to make that happen. On Sunday night, in the first one-on-one debate of this campaign, the American people will have the opportunity to see which candidate is best positioned to accomplish that goal. Thank you all very much.
Sanders' next major opportunity to make up ground will come on Tuesday when 577 delegates will be up for grabs in Arizona, Florida, Illinois, and Ohio. Florida, with its 219 delegates, will be the top prize of the night, a state Hillary Clinton won against Sanders in 2016. And Andrew Coburn is Washington, D.C. editor of Harper's Magazine. He says Joe Biden is not even a moderate, but a neoconservative responsible for the Iraq invasion and mass incarceration of African Americans. He spoke with WBAI.
He has never shown any sign of having a progressive bone in his body. The record is pretty well advertised now. I mean, he was the architect or prime mover of mass incarceration, made his name as a campaigner against school integration, very actively and energetically promoted the war in Iraq, stopped Anita Hill, basically effectively ensured the confirmation of Clarence Thomas, I don't know, endorsed right-wing coups in Central America. The list is endless, but I mean, the guy's a nightmare.
But how come he's considered a moderate and the two other alleged moderates in the race, Buttigieg and Klobuchar, have endorsed him?
Very interesting question. I mean, why those two endorsed him? And Buttigieg, remember, he promoted himself as representing generational change. For goodness sake, and then he endorses this doddering old fossil. It really shows the shallowness of the Buttigieg campaign and Buttigieg himself. Klobuchar, I think, naked ambition. And why was Joe Biden considered a moderate? Only in the warped political discourse that we have these days, moderate means it's like centrist, actually a thinly disguised code word for corporate shill.
And how does that differ from Donald Trump?
There's a lot of similarities between Biden and Trump. I mean, they both lie all the time. They both have a history of inappropriate actions towards women, and they both show fairly wobbly mental instabilities. Be careful not to say anyone is like Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is unquestionably worse than anyone we're likely to mention in this interview. On the other hand, there are distressing similarities. I mean, Biden, one would hope there'd be a step back from the really terrible policies we've had for the last few years. But, I mean, I think someone's pointed out that, you know, you'd think at least he'd promise to get back to Obama's deal with Iran, you know, at the very least. I mean, could he manage that? No, he can't. He has said, yes, he might consider it, you know, once Iran moves into compliance with the Iran deal. I mean, we flouted it. Trump just, you know, ended it. Biden, typical neocon position, is out to blame Iran.
What does this all tell us about the Russia-Ukraine scandal, Hunter Biden, Burisma, all of that? Was that what the Democrats made it out to be during the impeachment, a slur against a good man, Joe Biden, or was there some truth in some of the things being said?
The truth was self-evident that while Vice President Biden had overall supervision of our policy towards Ukraine, his son was making money out of what everyone agrees was a very corrupt Ukrainian energy company. That truth is self-evident. Biden, the Democrats and press, the Washington Post, the New York Times, who endlessly, I think there was a sort of special key on their keyboards that put in the words totally discredited or totally debunked accusation that there was somehow a link between Hunter Biden's self-evidently fishy deal with Ukraine and the fact that his dad was in charge of Ukraine. And somehow that's just gone by. I thought the Republicans did a pretty poor job of attacking that, but there you go. And I, you know, obviously we'll be hearing, if Biden gets the nomination, we'll be hearing a lot more about that from Trump and his people.
Do you think Biden is going to repeat the flops of Hillary Clinton 4 years ago and lose to Trump?
He'll probably show up in Michigan, and it'll be hard to have a campaign as inept as Hillary Clinton's. He was running a terrible campaign, and someone's taken him by the scruff of the neck, and, you know, with this sort of promotion of South, suddenly turning as if South Carolina was ever in doubt. suddenly it advertises a big comeback. It may well be, you know, he got the entire corporate media, the entire corporate establishment behind him on this, at least the Democratic wing. He may avoid some of the more obvious pitfalls, but on the other hand, I mentioned his mental stability, and I think you're going to be hearing a lot about that from Trump, especially if he goes on saying things like talking about Super Thursday or that he's running for the Senate. I'm sure he'll be closely monitored by his helpers, by his guardians.
We're in such a threatening environment with this coronavirus, and there's a real need for top-notch leadership, and what you're saying is not filling people with confidence.
Joe Biden, for God's sake, just look at him, listen to him. Remember when he tried to say these truths are self-evident? This is last week's one, I think. These truths are self-evident about the thing. The thing. You can watch that on any Republican channel. They're running it endlessly.
Andrew Coburn is Washington, D.C. editor of Harper's Magazine. And in local news, New York State Supreme Court Justice ruled in favor of a community lawsuit to stop the construction of four luxury towers in the Two Bridges neighborhood. That's the community along the Manhattan waterfront between the Brooklyn and Manhattan bridges. In a stunning rebuke to the city, Judge Arthur Engoron officially nullified the project's approvals that had been granted by the City Planning Commission. He ruled the city did not make the required findings under the zoning resolution to allow a modification to the Two Bridges large-scale residential development site zoning. Zishun Ning, a member of the Lower East Side Organized Neighbors, says the administration of Mayor Bill de Blasio sided with the developers of the four towers. He says zoning restrictions did not apply to the luxury buildings.
What the city tried to claim is that these towers are sub rights. That means that there's no regulation on it. It's just underlying zoning, which, as they claim, will allow as tall as can be as possible. These towers actually fall into the large-scale residential development. That will have specific guidelines that said any new development cannot destroy the neighborhood character and affect the environment of the surrounding area. These towers, at least 60 stories tall, each of them. Except the one which is already been built, that the other ones at most is like 20-some stories.
Another member of the group, Stephanie Crane, says it wasn't just the judge, but thousands of neighborhood residents and their sympathizers from around the city who opposed the project.
What happened in court didn't happen in just inside court in a vacuum, like in a legal vacuum. The Coalition to Protect Chinatown in the Lower East Side had created this petition where community members could sign saying they opposed the towers, and they also want to pass rezoning plan. So thousands of people signed, almost 6,000 people signed the petition demanding that the city not allow these towers to go forward. And it was all of the pressure. Even people outside New York City signed it, saying this is a monstrosity, this would destroy our community, this is not what the city should be doing, you know, enriching developers and displacing people. When the judge saw that, the judge is part of the public, and he's affected by public opinion and what people are demanding. So sure, he saw the community's perspective, clearly, that the developers and the city were violating the city's own zoning law to put the towers up.
What did his ruling actually say?
That these towers, but not only these towers, anything in the LSRD, the large-scale residential development, that's the zoning, the underlying zoning of the area, nothing could be built there that would damage the environment, that would block air and sunlight and change the character of the community.
So he gave you even more than you wanted.
Yeah, it was precedent-setting in that way. It was making official what we had known, what the community had known all along, but codifying it in a way, saying that nothing can be built that harms the neighborhood. So it's what the law was designed to do, but the city tried to break it, and so the community shut it down.
Crane adds that the case is being appealed by the developers.
The city is letting the developers do their dirty work for them. The developers are the ones appealing, so the city's hoping that the developers win on appeal.
And Ning adds that City Council member Margaret Chin, who represents the area, played off wealthier white residents in the East Village part of the Lower East Side against poorer residents of Two Bridges in Chinatown.
To try to like being racist to her own folks. To give you a little bit of history, right?
Yeah.
In 2008, the city approved East Village rezoning that would protect what was already the white middle class neighborhood from luxury high rises. Chinatown, Lower East Side, East Village, we're the same community. But they just protect the white middle class area, but not the Chinatown and the Lower East Side. At that time, her group, the Asian American for Equality, already support the East Village rezoning.
Yeah.
At that time, people already rally against this plan, saying it's racist, exclusion, excludes Chinese, blacks, Latinos. So under the pressure, Bloomberg came up and said, okay, then you guys should have your own protective rezoning. That's when the Chinatown Working Group was founded, and then more than 60 organizations were part of it. All through these years, we were able to develop a plan that will pretty much demand the same protection as East Village.
He says the Lower East Side should unite against being sliced up piece by piece by the city and developers.
Well, because that's how the city tried to pit one group against the other, right? To try to pit the white middle class against, you know, communities of color.
Right.
So in the end, nobody wins here because they can say, oh, you know, then there's no unity among the neighborhood. So when it comes to us, right, can we expect them to come? They already got their protection. Instead of getting the whole community protected. And that's actually the gimmick that the city wants to do with the Chinatown Working Group.
Right.
The plan we fight for is to cover the whole Chinatown and the Lower East Side. The plan calls for high limits on the whole area. And then it also discourages the privatization of NYCHA because they want to do the infill, which is to get the market rate units to be built on the public land. And we say that according to the plan, that any new development on public land should be 100% low income for the people with the income level of the community. And they also mandate that any new development to have truly affordable housing that looks to the that's based on the local area median income.
The lower area median income is a very high measure of what is considered low income in New York. It's the average of all the incomes in New York State or in New York City and several other counties, close to $40,000 a year, way above most people who would be able to, who would be looking for places to live if these buildings were finally constructed. Zixuan Ning is a member of the Chinatown Working Group. And finally, NCAA President Mark Emmert says NCAA Division I basketball tournament games will be played without fans in the arenas because of concerns about the spread of coronavirus. Emmert said in a statement Wednesday he made the decision to conduct both the men's and women's tournaments, which begin next week, with only essential staff and limited family in attendance. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, March 11th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.